Today is Thursday, December 20th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, a major announcement on Syria shocks even the president's Republican allies.
They're coming back now. We won, and that's the way we want it, and that's the way they want it.
A federal judge deals a blow to the president's immigration policy. A difficult week for the president with a mounting series of investigations. And holiday time movies not to be missed. It's all on today's International Edition. President Donald Trump is pulling all 2,000 U.S. troops out of Syria. The president suddenly declaring victory over the Islamic State, contradicting his own experts' assessment and sparking surprise and outrage from his party's lawmakers, who called his action rash and dangerous. He announced it in a tweet and later Wednesday posted a video on Twitter in which he said, "It is heartbreaking to have to write letters and make calls to the loved ones of those killed in battle."
We've been fighting for a long time in Syria. I've been president for almost 2 years, and we've really stepped it up. And we have won against ISIS. We've beaten them, and we've beaten them badly. We've taken back the land. And now it's time for our troops to come back home.
His decision immediately triggered demands from Congress, including leading Republicans, for more information and a formal briefing on the matter. Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, typically a Trump backer, said he was blindsided by the report and called the decision a disaster in the making. He said the biggest winners in this are ISIS and Iran.
ISIS is not defeated in Syria and Iraq. I was there just a few months ago. They've been incredibly hurt, and our troops there are an insurance policy against the reemergence of ISIS.
The U.S. began airstrikes in Syria in 2014 under the previous President Barack Obama, and ground troops moved in the following year to battle the Islamic State, or ISIS, and train Syrian rebels in a country torn apart by civil war. According to an official, the president informed Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan on his decision in a telephone call. Turkey has recently warned it would launch combat operations across its southern border and into northeastern Syria against Kurdish forces who've been allied with the U.S. in the fight against the Islamic State. Trump's declaration of victory was far from unanimous. An official said U.S. defense and military leaders were trying to dissuade him from ordering the withdrawal right up until the last minute. U.S. policy has been to keep troops in place until the extremists are eradicated. VOA's Victor Beatty asks David Mack, a former ambassador and currently a scholar at the Middle East Institute, if he believes the U.S. has actually won in the fight against ISIS in Syria.
I don't think that's at all clear. There's almost certainly a considerable number of Daesh or ISIS members who've stayed behind in one place or another. We know that there are substantial numbers along the Iraqi-Syrian border in some of those difficult-to-reach enclaves, and they will make problems. They will make problems in the future for the Syrian people. They will almost certainly make problems for the Iraqis, and they're certainly going to make a lot of problems for Kurds in both places. So I don't think it's at all clear that we have achieved the mission that we initially started out with, which was to eliminate the presence of this so-called Islamic State and to make sure that it couldn't recoalesce in the future.
There's a view that this plays well with the president's view that the U.S. should not be involved in open-ended conflicts. And, of course, the U.S. presence began under his predecessor, Barack Obama, who was also reluctant to get involved.
No, I think that's certainly the case. And certainly, I think President Trump was reluctant from the beginning. He's been, to a certain extent, cajoled into doing this by his military and civilian advisors and some of the senior people in the Congress. Among other things, they have pointed out to him that he criticized President Obama for having withdrawn too quickly from Iraq. And I think that this is likely to come back and haunt the president in the future. If he has any stomach for running for president again in 2020, this will certainly be an issue and one on which I think he will be vulnerable.
One of his staunchest allies, Senator Lindsey Graham, issued a statement saying there'll be devastating consequences, as you've potentially implied. He also said an American withdrawal at this time would be a big win for Islamic State, for Iran, Bashar al-Assad of Syria, and Russia. What do you think?
I think all of those things are true. But I also think it's particularly noteworthy that whatever justification President Trump has in his own mind for this rather precipitous withdrawal, it's the way he's gone about doing it. If, in fact, there had been a considered discussion among his senior advisors and with the president, and if he'd established some kind of calibrated and step-by-step withdrawal program, I think that could have been understood. But the fact that senior allies of his in the Congress of the United States, Republican members, were unaware that this was going to take place indicates that he also has not consulted with key allies of ours and people with whom we have ongoing relationships, and that would include the Israelis, the Jordanians, the Lebanese, the Iraqis, and the Turks, all of whom are going to be left in a somewhat vulnerable position with this precipitous withdrawal. And in fact, the impact is going to be much wider. It's going to be on a global basis as people continue to see that U.S. foreign policy is made on the fly by a president who gets up in the morning, has a particular impulse, acts upon his impulse without consultations with his own key domestic allies, to say nothing of foreign allies.
This decision comes just days after Turkey has threatened another military incursion into northern Syria that would directly impact U.S. operations and the Syrian Democratic Forces. Did that have any impact, you think?
Oh, yes. I can imagine that the president thought, well, this is causing a difficulty in the relations with Turkey. Let's just take it off the table, the way he took Jerusalem off the table, the way he's taken the Palestinian refugees off the table. The way he sees it is if there is an issue that is causing an ongoing problem, well, we just do away, we just say it's no longer an issue. And I think that's what he's trying to do here.
What happens to our Kurdish ally?
They're already distraught. In fact, although I've certainly not followed foreign reaction to this to any great degree, I've already been contacted by people who say that there's great consternation among Kurds in both northeastern Syria, where they've been our principal allies on the ground, and the Kurds in Iraq, with whom we also have long-term relationships.
That's David Mack. He's a former ambassador and currently a scholar at the Middle East Institute. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. A new report finds Afghanistan and Syria are the deadliest for journalists in 2018. Britain and the EU accelerate their planning for a no-deal Brexit. U.S. Central Bank boosts the benchmark interest rate in the U.S. And the World Police Body warns of a second wave of terrorists. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. A federal judge on Wednesday blocked Trump administration policies that prevented immigrants who suffered gang violence or domestic abuse in their home countries from seeking asylum. U.S. District Court Judge Emmett Sullivan declared that some of the guidance that then-Attorney General Jeff Sessions issued this year cannot be used to determine whether an immigrant has a credible fear of persecution or torture in their home countries, the first step to making an asylum claim in the U.S. It was yet another legal blow for President Trump's efforts to harden immigration policies without Congress changing laws. A U.S. judge in San Francisco Wednesday extended his decision blocking the Trump administration from enforcing a ban on asylum for any immigrants who illegally cross the U.S.-Mexico border. This, as new data obtained by the Associated Press shows that the number of migrant children being held in detention centers in the U.S. has skyrocketed, with many being held in mass shelters. AP correspondent Martha Mendoza has that.
The American Academy of Pediatrics president, Harvard University Center on the Developing Child, Stanford University's child welfare experts, they all concur that it's extremely dangerous for young children and for children in general to be institutionalized. And that's why this was banned in the United States years ago. By the mid-1900s, they shut down orphanages because it became very clear that institutionalizing children was creating lifelong trauma.
Mendoza reports also there has been long consensus among experts that it's damaging to house children in this way.
Right now, the federal government has about 14,300 migrant children in its care, and most of those kids are being held with at least another 100 kids. Many are being held with more than 1,000 kids. What this data tells us is that these shelters are bloated. As a result, kids are being held in very large programs. To be institutionalized with 100 other kids for months on end is extremely unhealthy.
Well, joining us, meanwhile, attorneys for the family of a Guatemalan girl who died in Border Patrol custody are concerned that Homeland Security's Office of Inspector General isn't the proper way to investigate the child's death. Lynn Coyle says that Jacqueline Kale's family is seeking a transparent investigation under recognized standards for the arrest and custody of children.
Mismanaging or denying in proper intake screening is a constitutional violation. So we need an inquiry to look at the actions taken or not taken to understand whether it met our constitutional standards, not the standards set out by Border Patrol.
Well, joining us now to discuss all of these issues involving immigrant children is Carolyn Miles, CEO and president of Save the Children. Thanks for being with us. Now, first off, what's your position on Wednesday's ruling on asylum?
We would stand by the fact that seeking asylum is not a crime, and that is a right of children to seek asylum and their families as well. That's really a fundamental issue of human rights for kids, and would stand by that position.
We've been hearing a lot about the situation on the border lately, the president seeming to classify it as a crisis, sending military. You have activists saying we don't need military people. We need people that can be support for the people that are coming through, language, et cetera. Of course, all of this in the wake of the tragic death of a 7-year-old migrant girl recently. There's a lot of confusion as to what actually happened, but I know you all are very heartbroken over this situation. What do you believe went wrong and should be done?
Obviously, the death of any child is a tragedy, as was this one. It does go to show that the journey is a very dangerous one. And I think to me, it points back to the fact that parents will only undertake that journey if the option for them to keep their children at home in their countries is so dangerous they feel like they can't do it. So the real issue here is the violence and the economic issues that people are escaping in El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras. And this little girl was from Guatemala. And families aren't going to undertake this journey, which is really dangerous, unless they think that there's a better life at the end, and the one that they're escaping is so difficult. And Save the Children works in all three of these countries. We work with children on this issue of violence, on resisting gangs, on trying to give youth opportunities to have a decent life and to have jobs and to escape gangs there. That's what we have to really focus on, I think, if we want to get to the root causes of these issues.
I have heard stories that many of these parents are well aware they may be separated from their children, but they're willing to risk it because it's so bad where they are.
That's right. And it is really horrible for many of these families where they are. When I was in El Salvador, I met a young boy who told me he was out with his friend and his friend got attacked by a gang and his friend died in his arms. This was a 14-year-old boy. Mm-hmm. And he said to me, "I'm afraid I'll never grow up here. I won't make it to be a grown-up here." And that's the kind of situation that many of these kids find themselves in, and their parents are obviously terrified for their futures. So that's why they leave.
But are we seeing such an enormous influx that we should be turning people away? Or has this just something that's been happening and just now being really cracked down by this administration?
It certainly has been happening. Have the numbers gone up? Yes, the numbers have gone up. But what's gone up even more is the number of kids that are actually in in detentions. The latest numbers, you know, go up to about 14,000 children who are being held in detention. And part of the reason that those kids are being held in detention is the slowness of the process that's been put in place by the administrations. And we know that detention is very harmful for kids. Not only is it harmful physically for children to be in detention, but it's really harmful from a psychological standpoint. Very, very bad thing for children. Right. These are kids that were seeking asylum. They come unaccompanied to the United States.
Okay. Are they coming on their own because their parents want them to get out of harm's way and they're sending them?
Yes, yes. Their parents are sending them because they think that there's a better future for them. Or their parents are in some cases here, and so they're coming to join their parents.
What do you think the United States should be doing with children that show up unaccompanied looking for asylum?
Again, children have the right to seek asylum. That is a legal right. And so what we should be doing is we should be going back to some of the previous policies that we've had, which has been to very quickly determine who the sponsors for those children are and release them to those sponsors. And the vast majority of those children do come back for their asylum trials. A number of those kids end up not being able to get asylum, and you're sending them back into harm's way. So the other thing that you have to do is work on the issues that are happening back in their home countries. And the kind of programs that you need to strengthen in places like El Salvador and Honduras and Guatemala are the kinds of programs that Save the Children and other organizations do. They're providing life skills to youth. They're strengthening child protection systems in those countries. They're trying to do positive parenting work with parents in terms of making sure they know what the risks are of sending their children. They're looking at getting schools involved in keeping these kids from taking those journeys. So there's a lot you can do in these countries to help these children.
That's Carolyn Miles, CEO and president of Save the Children. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
What is it like to study in the United States, and what do you have to do to get here? The Student Union is VOA's blog that follows students from all over the world as they face challenges and opportunities of studying at American universities. Log on at blogs.voanews.com/student-union.
VOA's International Edition continues now. It has been a few difficult weeks for President Trump, with his longtime attorney getting sentenced to prison as he continues to cooperate in the Russia probe. Another associate of Trump's, the publisher of a tabloid newspaper, also agreed to cooperate about hush money payments made to benefit Trump's candidacy. And on top of that, a federal judge Tuesday postponed sentencing for Trump's former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn, but not before scolding him over his crime of lying to investigators. And then we heard about numerous investigations into the president's campaign, his inaugural committee, the Trump Organization, and the Trump Foundation. Joining us now to sum up the week is Robert Deitz, professor of governmental affairs at George Mason University. So how much of a problem is all of this for the president?
My sense is that what's happening is a kind of a circling where, you know, the noose, the rope gets kind of tighter and tighter. And it wasn't that way for quite a while, but in the last couple of weeks, I think have been brutal for the president. And I think looking at the photographs in the newspaper, I think he's showing it. He's really showing his age.
How much trouble do you think he's in?
Oh, I think he's in a lot of trouble, from his standpoint, the problems are worse when he sees what's happening in these various court hearings. Judges often, and prosecutors for that matter, both send signals often in court proceedings. And I thought Judge Sullivan was sending an announcement very, very loudly to potential defendants, current defendants, and ultimately the president, that lying to the FBI is a really serious thing. And I think he was also, I believe I mentioned on this program, that Trump often sort of acted as though federal judges could be rolled. I think what Judge Sullivan was trying to say to General Flynn was, don't claim that you don't know. And he basically said this. You've been a government employee for, what was it, 30-some years. You were a three-star general. You've worked in the public sector your entire career. Don't try to tell me that you didn't know that lying to the FBI is wrong. And that's why I think Flynn's lawyers really disturbed him. And I think he was trying to have his cake and eat it, too. That is, yes, General Flynn is guilty, and he's admitting his guilt. But bear in mind, he was misled by the FBI, and Sullivan was having none of that. And that's why I think he postponed the sentencing.
Where do you think this all is now, and do you think it's wrapping up?
Oh, I think things are just humming along. I've told you in the past that I don't think we're anywhere near done, and I still feel that way.
At the beginning of this interview, I asked you if the president is in trouble here, and you said yes. Did you mean as far as politically or legally?
Well, I think the two ultimately are connected, but I meant legally. You know, bear in mind, because of Mueller's successes, and I know that the president would not describe it that way, but I think any reasonable person would, given the number of indictments and guilty pleas and so on, I think he has energized prosecutors in other contexts. And I have in mind particularly the Attorney General of New York. Apparently they are going to investigate tax issues. And already you notice that the Trump Organization agreed to give up the Trump charitable organization. But if they get into taxes, and it's very hard for me to see how that could be avoided, because the question would be the investigation of the organization's taxes. So you can't claim this sort of presidential argument that I can't be touched while I'm in office. Once they get into that, I suspect there are riches there.
That's Robert Deitz, professor of governmental affairs at George Mason University. Whether it's their accomplishments on Earth or in outer space, some notable people died in 2018, from singers to fashion designers to a former president. VOA correspondent Mariama Diallo tells us more.
I miss you, my friend.
Singer Smokey Robinson paid an emotional tribute to his childhood friend Aretha Franklin, who died this year following a long battle with pancreatic cancer. Franklin was a recipient of 18 Grammy Awards and sold more than 75 million records. Loved ones, celebrities, and political leaders, including former U.S. President Bill Clinton, were among the thousands to honor her.
She lived with courage, not without fear, but overcoming her fears.
Movie fans said goodbye to 1970s sex symbol Burt Reynolds and comic fans to Marvel comic magnate Stan Lee, who died at the age of 95.
That's for you, Stan Lee. That's for you, baby. You always will live in this heart. Forever.
The world also lost British physicist and author Stephen Hawking. He died at 76 in his home in Cambridge.
Stephen Hawking was a huge personality worldwide. He had this amazing ability to connect with people.
The fashion industry bid farewell to American and French designers Kate Spade and Hubert de Givenchy. An homage for Givenchy showcased dresses inspired by the creator's most iconic designs worn by stars like Audrey Hepburn and Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis. Spade took her own life. TV evangelist Billy Graham also died this year at the age of 99. Graham, who preached to millions around the world, was considered one of the leading spiritual voices of the 20th century.
I want to ask you tonight, do you love God? Do you love him with all your heart, with all your soul?
In South Africa, thousands of mourners packed a 40,000-seat stadium to celebrate the powerful anti-apartheid icon Winnie Mandela, who died at the age of 81. Africa lost another of its beloved figures, former United Nations Secretary General Kofi Annan. A Nobel Peace Prize winner, Annan was hailed as a guiding force for good. Astronaut Alan Bean, who walked on the moon, died at the age of 86. Bean traveled to the moon almost 50 years ago as a member of the Apollo 12 mission.
Well, it was like you won the lottery, only even better.
and a member of an American political dynasty died in 2018. Family and friends, including four former U.S. presidents and President Donald Trump, packed into the Washington National Cathedral's prayer hall to mourn U.S.'s 41st president, George Herbert Walker Bush.
A great and noble man, the best father a son or daughter could have. And in our grief, let us smile knowing that Dad is hugging Robin and holding Mom's hand again.
The late Bush was laid to rest in Texas next to his wife, who also died this year, and their daughter Robin, who died of leukemia at the age of 3. Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Washington.
Well, as Christmas approaches, many Americans will be heading to their local theater to see the latest blockbuster movie. Joining us now to talk more about a couple of those big movies that could possibly be awards ceremony winners, Vegas film critic Jeffrey K. Howard. Jeff, let's start with Aquaman.
Well, you know, Disney runs Marvel, and Marvel's had incredible success with their films, from the Avengers films to you name it. They are just making money hand over fist. They're popular. They're well done. And DC has, and Warner Brothers is having a really rough time of it. Their movies are not doing as well. They're too dark. They're not too family friendly, you know, from Justice League to Man of Steel to the Batman. They really need a hit. And now we have Aquaman, and probably one of the most laughable, lesser-known characters in the Justice League. I mean, he talks to fish. I mean, you know, it was kind of interesting to see why they chose Aquaman to this. But we have director James Wan, who is just an incredible visionary. He directed The Conjuring and Conjuring 2, so he really knows how to do thrillers. He really knows how to stage suspense, and he knows how to stage, incredible visuals. And so now we have Jason Momoa, who plays Aquaman. And Aquaman is a half-breed, meaning that the Queen of Atlantis, played by Nicole Kidman, she was going to be executed because she was betrothed to a marriage she didn't want to do. So she ends up going up to the upper world, meeting a man who runs this lighthouse, and falling in love with him. So they have a baby, the half-breed. But of course, the King of Atlantis finds out exactly where she's at, and she goes back to Atlantis to save her family, her human family. Of course, now, as Aquaman grows up, you know, he becomes this blue-collar kind of guy that lives on the East Coast, you know, like on the main somewhere in a lighthouse with his father. So when Atlantis comes calling, because Patrick Wilson is his brother, his half-brother, he wants to wage a war on the upper world above. And, of course, they come to Aquaman and say, look, you're the true king. We need you. We need you to come save not only your world but ours, too, and unite all seven seas, all the seven kingdoms. If that's not enough of the story to go on in this two-hour-plus movie, then we also have the classic comic villain who gets an introduction, the Black Manta. So, essentially, his real name is Arthur. He's King Arthur. The main part of the movie is Aquaman is looking for the special trident left by an ancient king that can unite the kingdom. It's got incredible special effects. Jason Momoa owns being Aquaman because he plays it with this real straightforward blue-collar kind of guy. He's just amazing. He is so perfect for this part. This is going to be a big hit for DC and for Warner Brothers. It's already grossed over $200 million worldwide, and this is going to be the holiday movie to rake in the cash. Also, it's a lot of fun. It's family-friendly. I was really surprised to see how there was some serious tones to the movie, but overall, absolutely can you take the kids to it, unlike some of the previous Warner Brother DC comic films. And here's what's cool. We're going to talk about Mary Poppins Return next, but get this. One of the sea creatures, this giant kind of kraken creature that guards the trident, is voiced by none other than Dame Julie Andrews.
Wow.
So how crazy is that?
Yeah,
so
cool.
There's this giant, nasty sea creature, and she's the one voicing the creature. So I thought that was really interesting that she turned down $1 million in Mary Poppins Return just for a cameo, but she decided to do the other big holiday film, Aquaman. It's a winner. It's going to be a nice series that they're going to do some more films to. Stay through the credits because there's Easter eggs to watch. This is the movie to see this holiday season.
All right, and then, of course, as you said, Mary Poppins Returns. I'm very excited about this one. And you've seen it, right?
Oh, absolutely. I saw it actually a few weeks ago. Disney showed it to all the critics because they were so excited about it, and rightfully so. This is not a retelling of Mary Poppins. This is an actual sequel.
Mm.
You know, the children that in the original film are now adults.
Oh, wow.
And they have children now. The brother and sister have children.
Mm-hmm.
And Michael Banks learns that his house is going to be repossessed in 5 days unless he can pay back this loan. They have to find this missing certificate that shows proof of shares in the bank that his father left them. Now, when they all seem things are lost, Mary Poppins shows up, their beloved nanny, now played by Emily Blunt, who can sing, who can act, who is just ultimately the most charming Mary Poppins since Julie Andrews. But she holds her own. She kind of gives her own identity to Mary Poppins. And Lin-Manuel Miranda plays this lamplighter, just like the chimney sweep Bert that Dick Van Dyke did in the original. He brings another kind of narration, and he bookends the movie, and he's in love with Jane Banks, and he is just a joy in the movie, too. All new songs by Mark Shaiman, who did Hairspray, and he's a well-known composer in Hollywood. Very, very addicting songs. You're going to come out tapping. You have cameos by Dick Van Dyke and Angela Lansbury as well. The great David Warner plays Admiral Boone. This is so much fun. I mean, I was smiling from ear to ear because they captured the essence of the original film.
Jeffrey K. Howard. That does it for today's International Edition. Thank you so much for joining us. Have a great day. I'm Lori London in Washington. Thanks for being with us.